she had required this second narrative in order to rescue herself in the first. She had needed to break the hold of the memory trick, discover again the extraordinary power of her imagination, and use it to restore herself to health. The one medicine that had always relieved her pain and healed her sorrow had been stories, reading them and writing them. She knew no other effective therapy. The hospital vignette faded into the other world, other life. A fleeting image rose in memory, herself at 6, with Captain in the bungalow kitchen, holding an index card in steel tongs, the white cardstock suddenly on fire, a butterfly of flame flexing its wings, butterflies bright and beautiful in the captain's eyes. If the past could ever truly be past, she had at last put it behind her. The future was now where all threats lay, and she had no option but to meet them in the world where she was lying in a hospital room, watched and monitored, as well as in this world of her own making. As she had recognized earlier in the night, when she'd yearned for Pax to find her, she wasn't dreaming. The shapen world of her extraordinary imagination was as solid as the quartz under her feet, as real as the hot pain that coruscated through the turnings of her damaged ear and throbbed in her bruised face. This place lay between heaven and earth, and where she would wind up at the conclusion of her quest couldn't be imagined. It had to be achieved. In spite of all her power, here in a world of her creation, she wasn't immortal any more than in the first world. She wasn't a god, merely a gifted imaginer. A shot to the head would put an end to her and all that she had imagined. If she died here, she died also in the world where she'd been born. And she wasn't confident about her chances. From her shoulder holster, she drew the pistol, considered it for a moment, then put it down on the black granite reception desk. One enemy remained. In this world, as in the one where she had been born, the ultimate enemy couldn't be dispatched with violence. In the wall behind the desk, three doors were paneled with the same white quartz that surrounded them. She chose the middle of the three, which stood under the red and black symbol of totalitarian power. Beyond the door lay a hallway that she followed to an elevator alcove. When she pressed the call button, one of 6 sets of doors slid open, and she boarded that car. According to the car station panel, there were 4 above-ground floors and a basement. The 4 lit without her touch. The doors slid shut, and she was whisked upward. In this world of her invention, she had imagined other people with power, and none more than he into whose lair she now ventured. She thought of Kelsey Faulkner, the silversmith and father of this man, half his face handsome, the other half ruined. She thought of Kelsey's wife, Beth, mother of the man now awaiting her, raped by her own son, stabbed 23 times, acid poured on her face. He took their money, unspecified items of value, and set out upon a new life, that teenage boy obsessed with Hitler and the occult. In the end, after Bibi had endured 4 taserings, once she had understood that she possessed the power, Chup Koi had been easily edited away, his role truncated to 5 appearances. But he had been a minor character and rather poorly imagined, with no past other than a reference to having been a police detective. By contrast, Robert Warren Faulkner, alias Birkenau Terezin, had a vivid and twisted past, a violent pathology that made him memorable. Besides, since this had begun, all the others who obstructed her were either members of Terezin's cult or in some way allied with him, which made him the spider at the center of the web, the primary antagonist. She couldn't edit him from existence without collapsing this entire imagined world. Only the most formulaic authors always knew when they began a story what the fate of their lead would be. When writing organically, allowing characters their free will, the author could be surprised by who died and who lived in the final act. The elevator arrived at the 4th floor. She stepped out of the alcove into a wide, dimly lighted corridor with closed offices on both sides. At the farther end, a door stood open. The light beyond shone somewhat brighter. She walked toward it. She was afraid, but not frozen by her fear. Wary, heedful, and prudent, yes, because valiant girls were always wary, heedful, and prudent. She had come here to save the life of Ashley Bell. And she realized now that somehow, if she accomplished that, she would also save herself from the death by cancer that threatened her in the world that was not of her imagination. Though she didn't understand why this should be so. If she failed Ashley Bell, she failed herself. Beyond the open door lay a very long room with a barrel-vaulted ceiling 30 feet high and walls curving to the floor. Olympian, not human in scale. Reminiscent of designs of Hitler's favorite architect, Albert Speer. The ceiling and walls were paneled in light cherry wood, finished with multiple coats of lacquer, glossy, with the depth of colored crystal, softly but dramatically lit by gold-leafed wall sconces that cast narrow fans of light both up and down. Here were the windows that Bibi earlier had thought were glowing spheres, mysteriously hovering in the fog, 7-foot diameter portholes, concave from this side, the panes captured in bronze muntins. Along the center of the wide chamber, the polished black granite floor didn't reflect any of the wall lights, and Bibi felt almost as if deep space lay underfoot, an interplanetary void where she walked without the pull of gravity. At the farther end of the room, before a wall hung with a tapestry replicating the red circle and black lightning bolts first seen in the reception hall, was an immense, stainless steel and black granite desk, unsuited to anyone but a mythic figure. If behind it had waited the Minotaur, with a human body and the head of a bull, or a horned mongrel as much goat as man, or some beast with furled wings and luminous green eyes, the desk and its owner would have been properly matched. Instead, waiting for her was a tall, athletic man in a slim-cut black suit of superb tailoring, a white shirt and a black necktie, with a red display handkerchief in his breast pocket. 17 years later, he was recognizable as the boy of 16 who murdered his mother and left his disfigured father for dead. He still parted his coal-black hair severely and combed it to the left across his brow, though anyone unaware of his obsession with the Third Reich wouldn't interpret the style as an homage to Hitler. To an extent, his good looks would insulate him from suspicion. For in this new century, image trumped substance, and appearance often mattered more than truth. He had been a handsome boy, and he'd become a man with movie star features and a glamorous aura. Hitler and most of the Nazi party hierarchy had been unattractive men, doughy and chinless like Himmler, or brutish like Hess and Bormann, in some cases even macabre. And yet, they had led a great nation into hell on earth, and a world into chaos and destruction. Had they looked like this Terezine creature, perhaps they would have enraptured even more true believers and would have triumphed. As Bibi approached, the elegant murderer came out from behind his desk and stood beside an office chair in which sat a young girl, her back to Bibi. The lustrous, champagne blonde hair was like that of Ashley Bell in the photograph found at Kalida's house. To Terezine, Bibi said, "Why do totalitarians, communists and fascists alike, favor the colors black and red?" The timbre of his voice, a masculine resonance halfway between bass and tenor, was a weapon as useful as his good looks. "Black for death, the power of life and death. Red for the blood of those who won't respect that power. Or maybe it's because they're the colors of the roulette wheel, the colors of fate. Our fate is to rule. Your fate is to be ruled. We are agents of fate, enforcing its dictates." "What a load of horseshit," Bibi said, stopping 10 feet from him. "Yes, isn't it? But, lovely Bibi, Horseshit is the preferred language of our times. He swiveled the office chair, turning his captive into view. Ashley Bell's right wrist was handcuffed to the arm of the chair. The girl you named by divination, Terezin said. Spelled out with Scrabble tiles. I'll take her from you now, Bibi assured him. The long blade flicked from the knife that she had not been aware he held. He put the razor-sharp cutting edge to Ashley's throat. In the creation of this quest, there had been two authors. The Bibi Blair who wrote fiction and thought she understood herself, and another Bibi Blair, the shadow Bibi with paranormal talent, who was cloaked from her twin by the memory trick. For both of them, the one medicine that had always relieved their pain and healed their sorrow had been stories. In the creation of the search for Ashley Bell, Bibi had sought the full truth of herself, because the truth included the power to edit some things in the real world as she could edit them here. The power to edit away her cancer. But Shadow Bibi had been determined to keep the knowledge of that power in the memory hole where Captain had sunk it, because it was the cause of the greatest traumas of her life. To prevent Bibi from realizing that her real adversary was her alter ego, Shadow Bibi had to invent an antagonist, Terezin, who seemed to be her only enemy. But now, Bibi and Shadow Bibi were one, united by the collapse of Captain's trick, by the restoration of memory. An antagonist was no longer needed. Lightly sawing the flat of the blade, not the cutting edge, back and forth across the child's throat, Terezin said, "If I kill her, I kill you." For a moment, Bibi didn't fully process that statement, didn't realize what it meant that Terezin should know such a thing. She was intent upon the need to edit him out of this world of her shaping, applying her metaphorical eraser to him as she had applied it to Chub Koi. He smiled and shook his head.
"That won't work, lovely Bibi. And if you think about it, you'll know why."
Chapter 126, The Dangerous Art. As she sensed the story slipping out of her control, Bibi felt oppressed, claustrophobic. The architecture supported that reaction. The long, cylindrical room and porthole windows suggested a vessel, a submarine, fog churning like a murky sea at the wedges of bronze-framed glass. Indeed, considering the grandness of this chamber and the megalomania expressed in its every detail, the vessel could only have been Jules Verne's Nautilus, and Terezin a stand-in for Captain Nemo with a measure of Ahab. He had said, "If I kill her, I kill you." The meaning of his words suddenly detonated, and Bibi stood shaken as if by a psychic concussion wave. He knew the true purpose of her quest. To save herself. To free herself of cancer by some as yet not fully understood interaction with Ashley Bell. But if he was only a character of her creation, devised for her narrative purposes, couldn't know anything about her other than what had happened in scenes that he shared with her. He couldn't know that to kill the child would be to kill her.
"The cancer's eating your brain," Terezin said. "Day by day, if not even hour by hour, your creative power as a writer will diminish. Until soon, you won't be able to construct so much as a short story, let alone a long quest. If I kill this girl, your exhausting journey to this moment will have been for nothing. You'll have to start over. All new characters, all new incidents. Cobble together another story to save yourself. And you don't have time for that."
Perhaps the cancer had already metastasized to the extent that her thinking was less clear than it had been. She knew what he said was half true, but she couldn't reason her way to an understanding of the other half. Her confidence declined, and apprehension stole upon her.
In the chair, the beautiful child maintained the expression that she'd had in the photograph, a hard-won serenity, a mask to deny her captor the pleasure of seeing her true emotions.
"Tell me," Terezin said, "in the swoon of writing, haven't you at times created a character who seems as real to you as anyone in your daily life?"
"Of course, but you're not one of them."
"And have you ever been surprised when a character evolves such a degree of free will that he repeatedly does things that you don't see coming, that you don't plan, but that seem truly in character?"
"Every writer who trusts her intuition has that experience. It's when you know a character is working, is true and right." Even a superior smirk could pass for an amused smile on his appealing face.
"And has there ever been a time, during your writing, when you've had the uncanny feeling that one of your characters seems almost aware of your hand in his life, of being imagined and shaped, and he rebels, makes you struggle to keep him as you want him?"
"No," she lied. "That doesn't happen."
"Fiction is a dangerous art, B.B. Blair. Creating new worlds populated by people as real as you can make them. Do you know how scientists explain the universe?"
She tried again to remove him, this time by the expedient of an aneurysm, then by imagining him dropping dead of a heart attack. He regarded her with an infuriating expression of forbearance, a smile tart with pity. When enough time had passed to make it clear that he would not succumb to editing, he repeated his question.
"Do you know how scientists explain the universe?"
"What do you mean?"
"They don't explain it."
"Oh, after the Big Bang, they can explain why and how it expanded as it did. But as to where it came from, that defeats them. Some say it came from nothing. They concoct grotesque, unprovable theories that purport to show not only that something can come from nothing, but that it happens all the time. Happens without reason. Is an effect without a cause."
In the chair, Ashley Bell closed her eyes in resignation, as though she detected some clue in the cadences of his speech by which she knew he would soon arrive at a crescendo that he intended to emphasize by slitting her throat.
"Quite a few philosophers," Terezin continued, "including some of the most respected and enduring, say the world was imagined into existence. The scientists who insist something can't come from nothing will ridicule the philosophers. But at least imagination suggests a cause and a power behind it. Considering that I exist by virtue of the story you've been telling yourself, I come down on the side of the philosophers."
"What's your point?" He took the knife away from Ashley's throat, allowing the light to wink off its point.
"Fiction is a dangerous art,"
he said again.
"Creating worlds involves risks. Not risks just to readers who may be influenced toward darkness instead of light, evil instead of good, despair instead of hope, but also to the author."
As long as the knife wasn't pressed to Ashley's throat, Bibi could rush Terezin, bowl him off his feet. He might hit his head on the granite desktop, drop the knife. She could see how it might be done. Surprise him by going for the office chair in which the girl sat, use her momentum and all her strength to wheel it backward into him. Imprudent, heedless of consequences. But considered action was always better than considered inaction. Yet she hesitated.
"When the author creates her characters," Terezin said, "she may think she knows what suffering should and will befall those who, like me, choose power over anything else. However, with your imagination, linked as it is to paranormal abilities, you empowered me in ways you couldn't anticipate."
With his left hand, he gripped Ashley by her brow and pulled her head back and put the point of the blade against the skin behind her chin bone. The opportunity to attack him was lost.
"Another way to do her would be to thrust the blade straight up through her mouth, through the soft part of her palate and into her brain. That would be quite a moment, don't you think?"
Behind her closed lids, the girl's eyes rolled. Terezin's eyes, which met Bibi's and challenged her, were lustrous, but absent all warmth. Black ice. Hitler had established the policies that led to the systemic extermination of millions. But he had never visited a death camp to watch whole families being shot or gassed, and sometimes conveyed into crematoriums while half alive. He'd never visited a slave labor camp to watch political prisoners, captured enemy soldiers, and Christian activists being starved and worked to death. When his cities were bombed, he didn't once walk the ruins to encourage his citizens and improve their morale. He could order savage violence, but he was too fastidious to witness it. If ever Terezin and his cult came to power, he would without compunction order mass murder, but he would also participate in it with pleasure. "If you mean to kill this girl no matter what," Bibi said, "you would have done that by now. You want something from me. What is it?"
"I'll let you save her and save yourself. All I want in return is, when you walk out of this story of yours, you leave this world intact. You leave it to me as my playground."
She thought he must be toying with her. "But this is all imagined."
"Somewhere, Huck Finn lives in his world, having adventures Twain never dreamed of. Sherlock Holmes is solving new cases even now."
Bibi hesitated to answer, afraid of saying the wrong thing. He was a megalomaniac, insane by any standard, though capable of functioning and succeeding in society, not unlike Hitler. If he truly believed that a fictional world continued to exist when the book ended, that on some mystical plane it was real and eternally rotating on its axis, there might be a way out of this impasse. "Leave all this intact?" she said at last, playing along with him, indicating the grand room and the fog-bound world beyond. "How does that work?"
"Finish the story. Publish it."
"You want me to sit down and write?"
"No. You've already imagined most of it. It's in your head. Just imagine it being on your computer, the computer in your apartment, in the world you were born into."
She almost protested that he had confiscated the computer in her apartment and that she had thrown away her laptop, tossed it into the back of a landscaper's truck when she was being sought by his men in the helicopter. Then she realized that those things had happened in this world, in this story, not in the real world, where she was dying of gliomatosis cerebri. Her confusion, even if brief, seemed to be evidence that the brain cancer was corrupting her intellectual capacity.
"I could jam this shiv into her brain through an eyeball," he said. "I could cut off her lips first, and her nose, and you couldn't stop me."
"You can have this world," Bibi said, certain that he wouldn't be this easily deceived, that violence was coming no matter what she said or did. His stare was glacial, but his voice contained a suggestion of childlike delight.
"You'll publish the full story as a novel?"
"Yes."
"And this world will be all mine?"
"If it works the way you think."
"Of course it does. You surprise me, lovely Bibi. You should have more faith in fiction. It lets you come sideways at the truth, which is the only way anyone ever gets near it."
He closed the knife and tossed it on the desk. The weapon slid across the black granite and came to rest, spinning lazily like the indicator on some game of chance. When he came toward her, she prepared to dodge a punch, another knife. But he only smiled and walked past and continued toward the open door at the farther end of the room. She imagined him dead of a cerebral thrombosis. Imagined a lethal aortal blockage in his heart. Imagined with great intensity, spontaneous combustion, Terezin consumed by fire, a lurching figure from which seethed blue-white flames as hot as the core of the sun, his body showering into glowing coals and ashes. He pivoted,
drawing a pistol from under his suit coat, stepped close to her.
Sometimes, a character understands the author as well as she understands him.
The muzzle of the gun, an empty eye socket in a fleshless skull, eternity rimmed in steel. He waited while she considered it, and finally raised her stare to meet his.
Somehow, each time you target me and fail, I grow stronger. Do you sense that, lovely Bibi? I do. I sense it clearly.
When she said nothing, he took her silence to be confirmation. He holstered the gun, turned his back on her, and walked away once more. She still didn't believe that he was finished with her. Perhaps she should have said nothing. There was one question she felt sure that he expected her to raise, however, and if she didn't ask it, he would conclude that her promise must be insincere.
"How do you know I'll really do it?" she called after him. "How do you know I'll leave this world intact for you?"
Halfway across the room, he paused and looked back.
"You're a girl who tries her best, who values truth, who keeps her word. You're my creator, aren't you? Well, if we can't trust our gods, who can we trust?"
She thought of a piece called The Creative Life by Henry Miller, in which he had written that madmen never cease to dream that they are dreaming. She was surprised that those 8 words should come to mind just then, so apropos to Terezin. But after a moment, she thought perhaps they cut too close to home, and she didn't dwell on them. She watched Terezin until he left the room and walked the corridor to the elevator alcove. Chapter 127. Bibi to Belle. The impossible Mojave fog, a ghost of the sea that had existed there millions of years ago, washed against the portholes. Deep in the whiteness, gliding shadows passed, immense and strange, as though Bibi's busy imagination couldn't resist supplying those intimations of the behemoths that plied the ocean of an earlier creation. Approaching the lovely girl, who sat with eerie equanimity, Bibi did a small editorial revision involving the manacle that cuffed her to the chair, and it clattered to the floor. Ashley Belle stood and stepped forward. She wore black patent leather shoes, white stockings, a white pleated skirt, and a crisp white blouse with pale blue embroidered butterflies on the cuffs and collar. They met face to face, no more than a foot apart. Her skin was flawless, as in the photograph, her features in exquisite proportion. Those wide-set eyes, the singular violet shade of certain hyacinths, were remarkable not solely for their color, but also because they were unusually pellucid, her stare direct and piercing, as if she didn't merely see Bibi, but also read her soul. "You're 13 and I'm 22, but we're the same height," Bibi said. "How can that be?" Ashley Belle smiled and said, "How indeed?" Bibi was surprised to hear herself say, "I know you. We've met before."
"Yes, 8 years ago.
"Where?"
"In a book," said Ashley Belle.
Wonder rose in Bibi.
"You survived Dachau."
"Yes."
"And wound up in America." "Those are the clothes you were wearing when the SS came for your family."
"My mother and father resisted. They were murdered, and I was dragged from the house."
Astonishment of the emotions, amazement of the intellect, and wonder growing. "That's where I saw the house before, in Toba's first book," Bibi said. "Toba Ringelbaum. It was a house in a German city, not in the middle of nowhere in the Mojave Desert. How could I forget you? Toba's wonderful book, Toba herself." She had taken from fact only what she had needed to craft her fiction,
and blocked from memory anything that might have made her realize that she was in a dreamlike state of creation, anything that would have allowed her to understand that she remained cancer-riddled and unable to go on any real quest for a cure.
"You grew up to be a surgical oncologist," Bibi remembered, "specializing in brain cancer."
"You don't need an oncologist, Biebs."
"Don't need me anymore," Ashley said.
"I was never really in danger. How could I be? With my story told and finished long ago, in a book now out of print. It was you who needed to be saved."
Her voice changed. Now she spoke with Bibi's voice.
"And you needed to overcome Captain's memory trick, so that you could discover that you had the power to cure yourself."
"Do I really? Do I have such power?"
"If you can imagine Jasper so vividly that one day a Jasper comes to you, well, surely then you can imagine yourself free of cancer."
As she spoke, Ashley Bell underwent a metamorphosis, her blonde hair darkening nearly to black. Her hyacinth eyes darkened as well, and her features became a mirror image of Bibi's. The Bibi who had been Ashley put a hand on Bibi's brow and then reached into her head as though flesh and bone presented no obstacle, her fingertips blindly tracing the surface of the brain, the gyri and sulci, the folds and fissures. This was an intimacy beyond Bibi's experience, and she stood breathless, for the brain was the throne of the soul. Some said that the soul didn't exist, and we all wondered from time to time if the skeptics might be right, if we might be only animals. But the Bibi, who had been Ashley, not only traced the gyri and the sulci, peeling away the web of cancer, but she saw what her fingers felt, saw the brain in all its complexity, and Bibi saw it as well, a masterpiece of gray matter, and within it, a soft light that wasn't merely the current of brain waves, but the shining and eternal essence of the girl whom Paxton loved. When the other Bibi withdrew her hand, tangled in her fingers were black skeins of tissue, alien and foul, which could be nothing other than the hideous threads of gliomatosis cerebri. She worked her fingers, rolling the spiderweb filaments into a glistening bundle as big as a golf ball before throwing them aside. She leaned forward, embraced Bibi, and whispered, "Let's finish this, Biebs. Close your eyes. Let's finish this and go home." When Bibi opened her eyes a moment later, there was only one of her, as should always have been the case. Alone, she moved slowly through the colossal room in a condition of purest awe, as she might have felt if she had been born and raised in a deep cavern and had come above ground after nearly a quarter of a century to see the starry night sky for the first time. She did as Terezin asked, imagining the entire quest onto her home computer and her laptop, though not for his benefit, only for her own, that she should never forget all that had happened. She harbored no intention of publishing the story. And she wouldn't leave this world that she had imagined for the mother-murdering monster to use as his playground. Let him perish with it. She was no god. She was a mortal liar. No need to walk the corridor or take the elevator, now that she understood the true nature of this place. She imagined floating, like a haunting spirit, down through the higher floors of the building, down, down, down into the reception hall, and a moment later, she found herself there. When she raised her eyes to the big red circle with twin bolts of stylized lightning, the inlaid stone melted as if it were wax and streamed to the floor. Around her, the white quartz walls began to lose their opacity until they became as transparent as sheets of glass, while at the same time, room 456 appeared like a heat-veiled mirage and began rapidly to solidify, though it was without patient or visitors. She didn't walk, but floated across the disintegrating reception hall floor toward the hospital bed, as the transparent walls of the building could no longer hold back the sea of fog.
Billowing white mist flooded across the scene, claiming forever what had been the future headquarters of Terrazine Inc., as it would claim the rest of this world that she had imagined into existence during the past 4 days, which for her had seemed to be only two. By the end, even the fog would cease to exist. The bed rail was down. She climbed onto the mattress, put her head upon the pillow, closed her eyes, and opened them to the sight of the four people whom she loved most in all the world. Chapter 128. God bless you, Eric Siegel. What can you say about a 25-year-old girl who died? That she was 3 years older than Bebe Blair. That she was the ill-fated heroine of Love Story by Eric Siegel. That she never had a chance, and she broke millions of hearts in her dying. When Bebe opened her eyes, she saw four hearts waiting to be broken. She at once gave them a reprieve by saying, "Wow, I'm not going through that again. Brain cancer sucks." As Bebe pulled the electro cap off her head, Nancy said, "Honey, wait, no, what are you doing?" "My hair's a mess," she said, as the EEG went into alarm mode, "and it stinks like stale sweat. I stink all over. Yuck. I can't wait to take a shower." When she sat up in bed and examined the catheter taped to the crook of her left arm, wondering if she might be able to remove it herself, Murphy went a bit nuts, seized simultaneously by tentative joy and trepidation, hands shaking and mouth trembling as he hovered, babbling, "You're awake. You're talking. Baby, don't get up. Chill out. Biebs, you can't get up. You're talking. Look at you. I love you. You're scaring me." To Pax, Bebe said, "Hi, Hunk. I love you more than oxygen." And to Pogo, she said, "You were there when I needed you, dude, loaning me your car. No. Wait, I invented all that. But if it had been real, you would have lent it to me, wouldn't you, sweet boy?" "Me jalopy, Asu jalopy," Pogo said. Pax and Pogo seemed to be riding with her abrupt recovery much better than were her mom and dad, almost as if they understood and had internalized a little of what had happened, though she couldn't figure out how that could be possible. In response to the EEG alarm, a nurse arrived. Recovering quickly from the shock of seeing her formerly comatose patient so animated, she tried to calm everyone and explained that the catheter could not come out until the doctor ordered it removed. "You still need to be hydrated, Bebe." "What I need," Bebe replied, "is 2 cheeseburgers and a pizza. I'm starving. A glucose diet sucks. Sorry I smell so bad."
"You don't smell bad," the nurse assured her.
"Well, see, I still have a nose, so while it's kind of you to say I don't smell, I really do. By the way, I don't have brain cancer anymore. We need to do all those tests again, so you can let me go home." She winked at Pax and said, "You look delicious. What are you grinning about?" Just then, a night duty intern arrived, as did another nurse, and a discussion ensued about whether or not Bebe still had cancer, who had the authority to order the tests, and whether they would have to wait until morning. Technicians were on duty to do everything from x-rays to MRIs. They had to be there for the ER, which never closed. Murphy and Nancy somehow got the idea that the problem was related to insurance company reluctance to pay for off-hour tests, and they declared that they would pay cash. To hell with the insurance company. Peck said he would pay for the tests, and Pogo said he would sell his damn car to pay for them. Finally, everyone was made to understand that the insurance company thing was a misunderstanding and that no one would have to pay cash. The head nurse on that shift reached Dr. Sunjay Chandra by phone. He expressed doubt that Bebe could know that she was cancer-free, doubt that it was even possible for gliomatosis cerebri to go into remission, but he ordered the catheter removed and the tests performed after Bebe spoke with him and told him she was symptom-free. When she got out of bed, her mother grabbed her, embraced her with the ferocity of a realtor who never let a client get away. Nancy was crying and laughing, and her kisses were wet, and she said, "How can this be? How can this happen?"
And Bibi said, "After all, it won't be what it'll be." And into her mother's confusion, she said, "I love you so much, Mom. I always have. I always will." Murphy was there. It became a group hug, and he was a bigger mess than Nancy. In spite of all his thrashing the waves, lacerating and shredding and riding the behemoths with no fear, big kahuna of his generation, he was nonetheless a softie, all heart and as tender as a kitten. He couldn't speak, except to say her name over and over, as if he had thought he'd never say it again to her alive. Pogo, too, looking at her with those blue eyes that melted other women, but with a love as pure as any that anyone had ever known. Her brother from another mother, adoring her as she adored him. "Biebs," he said. And she said, "Dude." And he held her just long enough to convince himself that she was as real as she had always been. In sweaty and rumpled pajamas, hair wild and tangled from being scrunched under the electro cap, certain that her breath could put a coat of rust on polished iron, Bibi nevertheless fell into Paxton's arms, and he folded her to him so that the hospital room seemed almost to disappear. She said that she was a mess, and he said that she was the best thing he'd ever seen, and she said she stank, and he said she smelled like springtime, and damn could that man kiss. When an orderly arrived with the gurney, and Bibi was transferred to it along with her IV rack, she said to him, "I'm sorry I stink," and he said,
"No, hey, I've smelled a lot worse."
Pax and Pogo and Nancy and Murph violated hospital rules by accompanying Bibi to every test venue, although they couldn't all fit in the same elevator with the gurney and the hospital personnel. Without asking permission, the four of them gathered with the MRI technician and watched through the big window as Bibi was conveyed into the ominous tunnel, waving at them as she disappeared headfirst. Everything went pretty much this time as it had when she had imagined being cured by the night visitor with the golden retriever, and had imagined being retested with astonishing results. When Dr. Chandra came to her room past midnight with a retinue of fascinated physicians, he said nearly the same thing he had said when she had imagined this meeting, that nothing in his medical experience had prepared him for this, that he wasn't able to explain it, that it wasn't possible, but that she was entirely free of cancer. She hugged him as she had done before, though this time she apologized for reeking like a pig. He told her that given her impossible brainwave patterns and now this miraculous remission, all manner of specialists would want to study her. Although she knew the reason for her cure, and though she intended to keep it secret within her little family, she agreed to make herself available in the weeks ahead. After apologizing in advance, she hugged him again. Dr. Chandra looked happy and wonderstruck when he said,
"On Wednesday, when I told you that you had at most a year to live, you said, 'We'll see.' Do you remember?"
"Yes. Yes, I do."
"It's almost as if you knew then that you'd be going home soon."
A post-midnight discharge wasn't unprecedented, but nearly so. Nevertheless, by 2:25 in the morning, Bibi was at her parents' home in Corona del Mar and in the shower, the water cranked up as hot as she could tolerate. Bliss. No one was sleepy, least of all Bibi, who'd had days of sleep or something like it. Pax and Pogo had stopped at a 24-hour market on the way to buy ground sirloin, hamburger buns, tomatoes, lettuce, and Maui onions. Because she'd been without solid food for more than 4 days, Bibi had been warned to start with a soft diet. But she refused to think that gastric distress could lay her low when cancer couldn't. By the time she came downstairs to the kitchen, her parents, her beau, and her best friend were singing along with the Beach Boys, drinking Corona, and grilling monster burgers with all the trimmings. Pax was the first to realize that Bibi's facial bruising was gone, that her crushed and abraded ear was as good as new, that she apparently had healed herself. As they regarded her with something akin to reverence, she said, "Yeah, I have some big news, and I don't know where all this is going in the days ahead. But wherever the hell it goes, compadres, if any of you ever looks at me again like you're looking at me now, like I'm something too precious for words, I'll kick your balls up past your gizzard. You too, Mom. They ate on the roof deck, with the night sea black to the west, and talked until the sky pinked in the east, and then longer still. And for most of that time, she sat on Pax's lap and touched his face from time to time and marveled. Chapter 129. Where She Goes From Here. The shingled bungalow hadn't been torn down by the people who bought it from Bibi's parents. She had imagined its destruction to facilitate the plot, themes, and atmospherics of her life-or-death quest. The house stood much as it had been in her childhood. On a sunny Tuesday afternoon, less than 48 hours after Bibi had been released from the hospital, she rang the doorbell, but no one responded. The new owners were nice people, not the suspicious Gillenhawks who claimed to be retired investment bankers in the alternate world of Bibi's fancy. They wouldn't mind if she enjoyed their porch for a while. The rocking chairs were gone, but she sat in one of the patio chairs, looking out at the street, where the tresses of the palm trees rustled in a shifting breeze, and the ficuses seemed to twinkle as their leaves, dark green on one side, pale green on the other, flickered this way and that in the changeable air. In the weeks after Captain died, she had sat here to write some of her stories about Jasper. And here, on a rainy day, a Jasper had come to her. As much as she loved her parents, they hadn't been able to understand her the way that Captain had understood her. And if she hadn't eventually imagined sweet Jasper into her life, she might have imagined the Captain alive again. She had desperately needed a dog suitably mysterious. To her, nature wasn't merely a beautiful engine that powered fate. She didn't believe in coincidence. Neither did Captain. Neither did dogs. In their constant joy and bottomless capacity for love, dogs were in tune with a more complex truth. This place would always be home to her. And perhaps one day she and Pax would own it. Home is where the heart is. No, nothing quite as simple as that. Home is where you struggle, in a world of endless struggle, to become the best you can be. And it becomes home in your heart only if one day you can look back and say that, in spite of all your faults and failures, it was in this special place where you began to see, however dimly, the shape of your soul. On Wednesday, she and Pax sat on a bench at Inspiration Point, watching the sea as it carried to shore millions of fragments of the sun and cast them, cooled and foaming, on the sand. With only 3 months to go on his current re-up, he had arranged to spend them stateside, assisting in the training of new recruits. He had given the Navy SEALs 10 good years, and he would give to Bibi what years remained. As pelicans flew in formation low along the coast, and sandpipers worked the wet beach for lunch, and a couple of hundred yards offshore, schooling dolphins arced in and out of the water, she and Pax talked about how cautious she must be in the exercise of her imagination. This wasn't her world to change, even if she thought that she could change it for the better, considering how disastrous might be the unintended consequences of her actions. Her greatest flights of fancy were best kept to the pages of books. If they had children, and they would, and if one terrible day cancer or some other hateful ailment threatened to cut short a precious life, she would have to risk those unintended consequences, as she might have to do as well in other extreme circumstances. Valiant girls, however, were always judicious and prudent. Pax wondered if she might be unique in all the world, or if perhaps everyone possessed latent powers of imagination equal to hers. She thought the latter must be true, because she didn't believe that she was special. She said, "If we were imagined into existence with a universe of wonders, then the power to form the future with our imagination must be in our bloodline." And out in the sun-spangled sea, the dolphins danced. On Saturday, Bibi had a lunch date with Pogo at Five Crowns in Corona del Mar. She arrived half an hour early and left her car in the restaurant parking lot. At the corner of Pacific Coast Highway and Poppy Avenue, she stood remembering the two teenage girls as she had last seen them, Hermione and Hermione, one blonde and one brunette, walking south to the corner and then west, not yet grown into their grace, leaning against each other, perhaps laughing, so alive. Bibi had known them only a short while, yet she had felt a remarkable affection for them because of their gameness and vulnerability, their combination of knowingness and innocence. That day, as they had faded out of sight in the fog, she had said to herself, "There go two dead girls," and had been distressed by that surprising thought. Now she understood the full meaning of those words. Hermione and Hermione, daughters of Harry Potter Faniax, had not been walking toward their murderer or anything as dramatic as that. They were two dead girls because they had never been living. They had been citizens of Bibi's imagination, who had never drawn one breath or laughed one laugh that anyone could hear. Now she walked the length of tree-shaded poppy to the sea and back again, past houses that she'd seen a thousand times. She studied each dwelling with greater interest than before, half hoping that she would glimpse those girls passing a window, discover them lounging on a deck, coming out a door. This casual search could end only as had the search for Ashley Bell, an encounter with no one other than herself. Nevertheless, she entertained a little hope anyway, as an antidote to the sadness that shadows every writer's heart. For all the effort of creation, for all the hours at the keyboard and the intellectual exercise and the emotion expended, all of a writer's creations are but a ghost of the truth, as ephemeral as are all the works of humanity in this world within time. Later, over lunch, when she shared that thought with Pogo, he said,
"Yeah, but just like me, you've got today. You've got today, and there's all of time and all the world in today. Walk the board, Dudette."
Chapter 130. She hears the song in the egg of the bird. At sunset, he came to the shop on Balboa Peninsula, near the second of the two piers. It wasn't a jewelry store named Silver Fantasies, and of course it never had been. Newport Beach had never been home to a silversmith named Kelsey Faulkner, and no child named Robert Warren Faulkner had ever murdered his mother here. The space was occupied by a souvenir shop that sold items made of seashells and driftwood and chunks of drift glass smoothed into sinuous shapes by the ceaseless action of the sea. He had no past, except the one that she had invented for him. But it was a past he liked, and it portended a future that excited him. He could document a past for himself with ease, one that would be without blemish, designed to withstand scrutiny. He didn't even mind starting from scratch, so to speak. He had only the black suit he was wearing and the cash he'd had on him when last he had seen her. He possessed certain strengths and talents, however, and would surely make rapid progress. As the sky caught flame across the west and purpled in the east, he returned to the car that he had stolen that afternoon. He drove to the head of the peninsula, and then a short distance south on Coast Highway, finally turning inland, abandoning the vehicle on a side street that he had selected earlier. This was such a rich world, with so many prospects for a man of his good looks, charm, sharpness of mind, and determination. With all due respect for her extraordinary powers of imagination, the woman's world was a thin soup compared to the thick stew of this reality. Her mistake had been to craft a narrative in which he had become aware of her true nature in the imagined world that they had both left behind. He had then realized the existential danger that he faced, and the opportunity. In the ruby and sapphire twilight, as he walked to the nearby high-end supper club that he had scoped out earlier, he cautioned himself not to underestimate the spunky Ms. Blair. Her imagination was such that she could hear the song of the bird when it was still but a yolk in an egg. Sooner or later, she might wonder if she had opened a door for him by imagining her entire quest for Ashley Bell onto her computers in this world. Once that thought rooted in her, she would be forever on the watch for him. And if she recognized him, dogged in pursuit. He would need to change his appearance, lose the current haircut for starters. The homage to Adolf was a childish touch, anyway. When he built a power base, when, not if, and when the time came to move boldly and publicly against his enemies, which were the same in this world as in the previous one, he would start by burning the books. Those of lovely Bibi would be in the first pyre. She would appreciate the irony. She had created him with a hatred for books and bookish people, and she would reap the consequences of that hatred. Just as her books would be among the first set ablaze, she would be on the first train to the first death camp. Overlooking Newport Harbor, the supper club was elegant in the extreme, luxurious, sensuous, decorated in shades of blue and gray, with black and silver accents. Large windows offered views of yachts at anchor and smaller boats cruising the twilight as dock lamps and house glow began to glimmer romantically across the darkening water. The bar was large and well attended, clearly a gathering place for the well-to-do, especially singles of all conditions, divorced, widowed, never married, and single for the night only, hoping to hook up with those just a step below or above their station. He ordered a martini, pretending not to notice the women who were interested in him, even as he surreptitiously cataloged and evaluated the qualities of each. The quickest way to acquire a fortune, a network of valuable social contacts, and a respectable position in society would be to marry a woman who already possessed those things. In the other world, Bibi imagined him a cult leader, then a young, high-tech billionaire. But with money and position, he would more quickly achieve his goals through politics, whether he was the golden boy candidate himself or the manipulator of such a one. He didn't care which. The woman would need to be beautiful, but not too sexy, not flashy, elegant, stylish, cultured. Ideally, she would be several years older than he was and not quite as attractive, so that she would be flattered by and grateful for his interest in her. He spotted her across from him at the Horseshoe Bar, a cool blonde who might have been 40, 42. A single exquisite diamond pendant and a forefinger ring of the highest caliber were all she needed to declare her unmarried status and the depth of her wealth. Their eyes met a few times. When the bar stool next to hers became available, she looked boldly at him and, with a coquettish glance, indicated the empty seat. Carrying his martini, he moved with self-assurance to her side. Her name was Elizabeth Barrett Radcliffe, but friends called her Beth. If he were to avoid drawing Bibi Blair's attention in the years ahead, as he became an increasingly prominent person, he couldn't, of course, call himself Robert Faulkner or Burke Terezin. He needed a simple but solid name, a name of substance. And one had occurred to him earlier. Quite a lot of time would pass before he would realize that this name had been a literary allusion that Bibi made in her first novel, which she had imagined him reading after she had come to his attention in that other world of her invention. He introduced himself to Beth, but it wasn't then, at that early stage when he might have avoided the error, that he discovered the trap into which he had stepped. Beth wasn't a bookish person, and as her elevated social circle wasn't very bookish either, the former Burke Terezin established his new identity with impeccable forged papers. A few years later, he was fast on the rise with that new name, before he discovered it was also the name of a sociopathic murderer in 5 novels by Patricia Highsmith, Thomas Ripley. By then, his picture had been in many admiring newspaper articles, his name in headlines, and he could only suppose that she had become aware of him, had recognized him even with his new look, as she might not have done if he had been named Bob Smith.
He couldn't decide how worried he should be until that same night he woke in terror from a dream involving assassins. After leaving bed and hurrying to his home office, he searched the internet for a photograph of B.B. Blair's husband, who had been a Navy SEAL. Ripley couldn't help but be alarmed to discover that the spouse of such a famous author seemed never to have been photographed. Paxton Thorpe's photo was also missing from the public archives of former SEALs. And what of the men with whom he had served, all of them special ops veterans? What did they look like? Without quite knowing how he'd gotten there, Thomas Ripley found himself at a window, peering out at Newport Harbor, at his private dock, past his impressive yacht, to where reflections of the moon trembled on black water. Only the moonlight, rippling. Nothing else. All seemed as it should be, as it would until... He stood there, waiting in a torment of imagination.
The End. This is Susie Jackson. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Ashley Bell by Dean Koontz. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being